Bernie Sanders was a serious contender for the Democratic Party nomination. Sanders wasn't even a member of the party. He was a self-declared democratic socialist. He was a confirmed foe of Wall Street. In 2008, he had voted against TARP. He called for the big banks to be broken up. He wanted bankers jailed and a return to New Deal-era banking regulations. The spirit of Occupy energized his troops. With independents and young voters, he was wildly popular. The fact that Sanders was viable as a candidate reflected the finding of opinion pollsters that among American voters under the age of 30, more had a positive view of socialism than of capitalism. The anger of 2008 was still very much alive, and Sanders fanned it. Hardly a rally went by without crowds shouting their indignation at the bailout. Regular Americans were still struggling back from the recession. As Sanders pointed out in a typical flourish in September 2015, applauding the Fed's decision not to raise interest rates, "At a time when real unemployment is over 10%, we need to do everything possible to create millions of good-paying jobs and raise the wages of the American people. It is now time for the Fed to act with the same sense of urgency to rebuild the disappearing middle class as it did to bail out Wall Street banks 7 years ago." Harping on the historic injustice of 2008 not only played to Bernie's base, it was an excellent weapon with which to beat the front-runner Hillary Clinton. Clinton was the consummate insider. She was a former Secretary of State and Senator for New York, and as such, irredeemably entangled with Wall Street. By the spring of 2016, Clinton and Sanders were dueling over Dodd-Frank. Sanders wanted to go back to the decisive moment in 2009 and do it right, to break up the banks. Clinton's answer was that Dodd-Frank should be rigorously enforced. This teed up Sanders to ask whether Clinton's reticence had anything to do with the $600,000 in fees she had collected giving speeches for Goldman Sachs. Would she release the transcripts? For the left, Clinton's Goldman Sachs speeches were what her Libya emails were for her opponents on the right, a further sign of her untrustworthiness. How deeply was Clinton entangled with a bank now better known as the Vampire Squid? Even the New York Times called for Clinton to release the text of the speeches. Weighing the issue, her campaign managers decided that Clinton's words were not, in fact, fit for public consumption. She would look too friendly to the banks. We know this because, starting in July, as she closed in on winning the nomination, internal memos from the Clinton campaign began to be dumped en masse in WikiLeaks folders. Who, in fact, compromised the security of the Democratic Party machine was to become a matter of complex technical and legal dispute, but at the time the conviction rapidly took hold that it was down to hackers with ties to Russia. Was the mounting confrontation with Putin, which had reached a new pitch in intensity over Ukraine and Syria, blowing back on the United States, and on Clinton in particular? Behind the scenes, America's intelligence agencies scrambled to uncover the extent of Russian interference in America's presidential election. On the basis of sources inside the Kremlin, they were forced to conclude that given Clinton's well-known hostility to Putin's regime, Moscow was doing what it could to derail her campaign. Even if the Russians could not change the outcome, they would do their best to undermine the legitimacy of America's already fragile political system. Moscow was serving notice that two could play at the game of regime change. By the fall, Obama was seriously weighing his options, including sanctions that would, in the words of an anonymous administration source, amount to cratering the Russian economy. That scenario did not unfold because Putin pulled back. But it was clear that this would be no ordinary election. Quite how unusual it would be was becoming clear on the Republican side. Whereas the battles within the Democratic Party had a clear-cut left-versus-right logic, and the establishment maintained its grip, what was happening to the Republicans was more disorientating. The GOP was out of control. In truth, the party had never recovered from the shipwreck of the late Bush presidency, the shock of 2008, and the Tea Party mobilization triggered by the financial crisis. The splits within the party that had precipitated the congressional budget crises of 2011 and 2013 were wider than ever. In 2013, the shutdown was called off as default loomed, but the right had had their taste of blood. First, in June 2014, they unseated the leader of the House, Eric Cantor, in a primary. Then, in October 2015, the ill-fated John Boehner was ousted as House Speaker by mobilization of the right-wing Freedom Caucus. With the party in turmoil, the establishment candidates who had been expected to dominate the presidential primaries, figures like Jeb Bush, rapidly faded. It was the darlings of the right who surged to the fore. The dark money of the billionaire donors, led by the Koch brothers, swung behind Texas Senator Ted Cruz. But it was Trump who took the votes of the Republican base by a majority of almost 2-1. If Jamie Dimon quipped that to make sense of Dodd-Frank, one needed the services of a lawyer and a psychiatrist, the same is no doubt true of the business of deciphering Donald Trump. But historians can contribute, too. Trump offered to a bewildered present a throwback to an earlier era. Born in 1946, the same year as Bill Clinton, Trump would take office at 70 years of age, recycling a rancid version of the baby boomer narrative which in the 1990s had still seemed fresh. Trump's racial attitudes reflected the animosities of the era of civil rights, desegregation, and New York in the 1970s. His boorish manners and sexism echoed the Manhattan party scene of the 1980s, when bond traders toasted one another as big swinging dicks. The sense of national crisis that drove his campaign was a reflux not so much of the recent past as of the first moment when modern Americans felt the world changing around them, the late 1970s and early 1980s. The trauma of defeat in Vietnam, America's urban crisis, and angry Japan bashing. 30 years on, Trump was still harping on those fears, but now transposed onto new enemies, China, Islam, and undocumented Latino immigrants. His main shtick was that he was a businessman, a deal-maker, and because his business was real estate, Trump lived the American business cycle close up. As Hyman Minsky, the legendary analyst of financial crises, observed already in 1990, Donald Trump was the very epitome of a Ponzi scheme capitalist, living hand to mouth by borrowing against the expected appreciation of his assets. As a result, crises punctuated Trump's career. He was hit hard by the early 1990s recession, almost losing his business. By 2008, he was less vulnerable, having diversified into media and branding. But his real estate exposure was still significant. Indeed, he was seeking to increase it. In 2006, he started a mortgage brokerage and announced plans to open a mortgage lending business. Luckily for Trump, neither got off the ground. By 2008, his casino business was failing again and would ultimately close. But Trump's real vulnerability was a gigantic condo development in Chicago. It was a spectacular project, the tallest building to be built in the United States since the Sears Tower, and sales had originally gone well. But in 2008, Chicago condo sales stopped dead. By the fall, it was clear that Trump and his business partners were in trouble. Since his bankruptcies of the 1990s, Trump was no longer on good terms with the major American banks, so the Chicago project got its funding mainly from Deutsche Bank's North American real estate arm. In the first week of November 2008, as Barack Obama celebrated his election victory with his adoring Chicago base, Deutsche and Trump went to war. Deutsche sued for $40 million, for which Trump was personally liable. Trump responded with an astonishingly audacious legal broadside. He claimed that the greatest financial crisis since 1929 constituted force majeure, akin to a natural disaster. He therefore demanded more time for the project to pay off. Deutsche's own suit was typical of a predatory and dangerous lender that had helped to bring on the crisis. Trump's countersuit claimed $3 billion in compensation for the damage it was causing to his reputation. It was pure legal swordplay, but it bought him the time he needed. In a tight spot, Trump is nothing if not pragmatic, and he was certainly not one to be squeamish about the maxims of free market economics. Faced with a 2008 crisis, he knew that American business needed all the help it could get. He had decades of experience working the subsidies available from American government. He liked the cut of Obama's jib. 2009 was not his moment to get on the anti-Obama bandwagon. As he remarked to a bemused Fox News host, commenting on an early Obama appearance, "I thought he, Obama, did a terrific job. This is a strong guy, knows what he wants, and this is what we need. It looks like we have somebody that knows what he is doing, finally, in office. And he did inherit a tremendous problem. He really stepped into a mess." On Obama's stimulus, Trump was equally unabashed. "Well, something had to be done. And whether it's perfect or not, nothing is perfect. And it's a whole trial-and-error thing. It's a very, very tough. We're having the worst year, the worst couple of years since the Great Depression. And you mentioned the early 80s. I mean, the early 80s get blown away by this deal. When you look at the banks, had trillions of dollars not been poured into the banks, you would have an insolvent banking system, and then you would absolutely have 1929. They did the right thing." Whereas Trump was reluctantly willing to support the bank bailout, he was positively enthusiastic when it came to helping Detroit. "I think the government should stand behind them 100%. You cannot lose the auto companies. They're great. They make wonderful products." When conservative interviewers tried to deflect Trump toward the cause of tax cutting, it was an easy sell. Trump doesn't like paying tax. But he stuck to his guns on stimulus spending. Building infrastructure, building great projects, putting people to work was the right thing to be doing. 6 years on from the crisis, Trump's enthusiasm for an activist, engaged, strong presidency remained. What had changed was his attitude to Obama, which had curdled from admiration to vituperative animosity. It was this that formed the bridge to the right, not programmatic or intellectual affinity, but the tabloid absurdity of the National Enquirer and the birther conspiracy. Despite having cultivated minority audiences early in his television career, Trump now played the race card. In 2013, after Romney's defeat radicalized the right wing, Trump positioned himself ever more aggressively as a spokesman of the anti-immigration wing of the Republican Party. By 2014, he had branded the idea of building a wall, and had literally trademarked the slogan, "Make America Great Again." Xenophobia, nationalism, and an apocalyptic diagnosis of America's situation formed the bridge. The right wing loved Trump's slogan, as much for what it acknowledged about the present as for what it promised for the future. America, their America, was in trouble. If in the Republican primaries it was above all Trump's unabashed appeal to white male voters that swung the decision, what made this worrying for the party establishment was the way this correlated with his appeal to economic nationalism. Since the 1980s, the party leadership had nailed itself to the mast of globalization. The idea of NAFTA was launched by the Reagan administration. It had been crafted by Bush Sr., only to be carried across the line in 1993 by Clinton. In the 1990s, globalization was a bipartisan project of the Republicans and the Reubenite wing of the Democratic Party. Their push extended not only to goods and capital, it extended to labor, too. The business lobby favored immigration reform, which would give residence rights to the large and cheap workforce of undocumented migrants. Opposition to regulation of all kinds, freedom for labor, goods, and capital, were the ideological bracket that joined American business interests in a single block, from small contractors to the Davos set. There were sectors, perhaps most notably in coal mining, where this alignment did not hold. In polluting industries such as fossil fuels, opposition to globalism, the rejection of the politics of climate change, and the blue-collar appeal of American nationalism fit together all too neatly. But those were exceptional cases. On the whole, the Republican Party preserved an uneasy truce between the nationalist base and the globalist leadership. In the 1990s, the right-wing nationalist campaigner Pat Buchanan had twice threatened to undo that fragile balance. But it was the progressive breakdown of party coherence after 2008 that really tore it apart. In 2015, Trump exploded onto the scene with the alt-right squarely behind him, and transformed the debate. untouched by concern for economic doctrine, his updated version of 1970s Japan bashing energized the party, promising to keep illegals out and to bring blue-collar jobs back to America. Following their new tribal leader, Republicans abandoned free trade en masse. The percentage saying that free trade agreements were bad for America surged from 36% in 2014 to 68% 2 years later. By that point, only 24% of Republicans were still willing to fly the flag for free trade. For the Republican elite, as Trump stormed to the nomination, it was bewildering. "The pillars of the Republican economic agenda have completely collapsed into dust," a member of the American Enterprise Institute acknowledged. "They're gone, at least for this election." The U.S. Chamber of Commerce did not go down without a fight, openly challenging the Republican nominee on the issue of trade, but to no avail. Trump and the protectionist agenda triumphed. The result, by the summer of 2016, was a remarkable inversion. Though, behind the scenes, oligarchic mega-donors were hard at work stoking the flames of right-wing radicalism, America's name-brand corporations no longer wanted to be associated with the Republicans. When Romney won the party's nomination in 2012, the money men had flocked to the party. Corporate America lined up to sponsor the Republican convention in Tampa. In 2016, no big names in American finance wanted to be associated with the platform from which Trump would give his apocalyptic acceptance speech. Even if some of the Wall Street top brass felt loyalty to the GOP, they could not stomach Trump and did not want to risk insulting their clients or their workforce. It was a matter of business culture. As one PR advisor commented, "Any corporation will look at this from the perspective of whether or not they would want their CEO sharing a stage at Davos, Aspen, or Sun Valley with a Republican nominee. If the answer is no, they won't be going to Cleveland." Remarkably, the consultant felt necessary to explain. "The risk of violence in the convention, between pro- and anti-Trump protesters, is secondary, as security will be strong inside the perimeter." America's incipient Civil War atmosphere was less of a concern than the question of whether Mr. Trump and the ideas he represents are homogeneous with a company's brand and business plan. No one wanted images of Confederate flags waving over corporate brands. And the 2008 financial crisis was on the mind not only of Sanders supporters. In the pages of the Washington Post, former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson put the question, "What would have happened if a divisive character such as Trump were president during the 2008 financial crisis? The only reason we avoided another Great Depression was because Republicans and Democrats joined together to vote for the Troubled Asset Relief Program." In fact, as Paulson knew firsthand, the bipartisanship of 2008 had not come easily. Divisions within the GOP had almost derailed the Bush administration's efforts to contain the global bank run. It was the Bush, White House, and the Democrats, not their Republican counterparts in Congress, who carried the unpopular crisis-fighting measures. Now, Paulson warned, "We are witnessing a populist hijacking of one of the United States' great political parties. The GOP, in putting Trump at the top of the ticket, is endorsing a brand of populism rooted in ignorance, prejudice, fear, and isolationism." This derailment of one of America's ruling political parties posed a threat that was no less than systemic. For Paulson, this left only one choice. He called on his fellow Americans to back Clinton. In fairness, Trump might have countered by pointing to his track record. In 2008, he had vigorously applauded the bailout. But Trump in 2016 had no desire to remind his supporters of that. Candidate Trump was no longer the high-rolling New York wheeler-dealer of 2008. He had morphed into something altogether darker. The man running his presidential campaign was Steve Bannon, the sulphurous impresario of Breitbart and self-proclaimed Leninist of the 2013 shutdown. He was only too happy to take up Paulson's challenge. In Bannon's dark vision of American history, the moment on the morning of September 18, 2008, when Paulson and Bernanke confronted President Bush with a need for a massive bailout, marked a new epoch. What Bannon called the fourth turning, the opening of an apocalyptic phase of struggle. On the morning of September 18, 2008, the United States had come close to losing its soul. For Bannon, the mission of the Trump presidency was to seize back control from the globalist elite. As the extraordinary final TV spot of the Trump campaign declared, "It's a global power structure that is responsible for the economic decisions that have robbed our working class, stripped our country of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities." The images accompanying the voiceover put faces to that global power structure. George Soros, Fed Chair Janet Yellen, and Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs. From the richest businessman ever to run for president, it was a remarkable anti-business message. It was also the most transparently anti-Semitic campaign spot in recent history. Whether one agreed with Bannon or not, there was no denying that in the decade since the crisis began, American politics had traveled a long way. Back in 2007, former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan had been asked by the Zurich daily Tages-Anzeiger which candidate he was supporting in the upcoming presidential election. His response was striking. How he voted did not matter, Greenspan declared, because we are fortunate that, thanks to globalization, policy decisions in the U.S. have been largely replaced by global market forces. National security aside, it hardly makes any difference who will be the next president. The world is governed by market forces. This was the mantra of an age of globalization without alternatives. Of course, Greenspan didn't simply approve of a world governed by market forces. He had done as much as anyone to create it. As Fed chair, he had made the markets into the ultimate arbiter of American economic policy. In the early years of the Clinton presidency, he had helped to shepherd the Democrats into a new partnership with Wall Street, thus further limiting the political alternatives on offer. Globalization was not a natural process opposed to politics. It had been shaped since the 1940s by an alliance of America's politicians, business elites, and policy experts like Greenspan. The election of 2016 revealed how severely the crisis of 2008 had shaken that alliance and the world it had fostered. Most fundamentally, the crisis had exposed the deep unreality of Greenspan's conception of a world governed by markets. As the crisis revealed, government by market forces was at best a fragile condition. As the global financial system imploded, it was the markets themselves that needed governing by state action on a gigantic scale. And that meant that who governed and where they obtained their political support was not incidental. Elections and party politics did matter. Indeed, faced with the choices in 2016, even Alan Greenspan was no longer indifferent. Unlike Paulson, he could not bring himself to endorse Clinton. But he did warn journalists that the economic and political environment was the worst he had ever been remotely related to. He was deeply concerned that crazies risked undermining America, and contrary to his confidence 10 years earlier, he now admitted that, politically, I haven't a clue how this comes out. The Trump campaign may have seemed crazy, but it was not asleep at the wheel. Online media immediately hit back. "Who's Greenspan calling crazy?" pro-Trump websites demanded to know, and then they turned the tables on the former Fed chair and his successors. Were Trump's policy positions crazier than negative interest rates? Crazier than paying banks to keep loanable funds in sterile depository accounts at the Fed? Crazier than having the Fed buy up trillions in government debt, remit the interest payments back to Treasury, and then count that as revenue to the federal budget? If all of this now passed for normal monetary policy, was their candidate crazy for denouncing the Fed for fueling a false economy and an artificial stock market? With the Fed balance sheet expanded to $4.4 trillion in pursuit of a full employment target mandated by legislation passed in the days of Jimmy Carter, could one seriously deny that the economy was politicized? Were the Trump and Sanders campaigns crazy, or simply stating what should have been obvious, the fiasco of the project of Greenspan's generation? Financial globalization that Greenspan and his ilk had worked so hard to institutionalize as a quasi-natural process had been exposed as just that, an institution, an artifact of deliberate political and legal construction, with stark consequences for the distribution of wealth and power. Disturbing as they were to the status quo, in the summer of 2016 the most common response to the Trump and Sanders campaigns was to dismiss them as a passing spook. Once Clinton had knocked Sanders out, she would beat Trump by a landslide. While the alt-right continued to fly the flag, Republican donors shifted their money from the presidential campaign toward House and Senate races, with a view to ensuring that as president, Hillary Clinton would face a solidly hostile Congress. Only the inner core of Trump's campaign and the audience of Fox News, swaddled in what the mainstream denounced as alternative reality, continued to believe in victory. On election night, even as the results swung Trump's way, the mainstream media could barely hide their disbelief and dismay. Within hours, the recrimination and finger-pointing began. It was the white working class and the racists who had rallied to Trump. Women and minorities had failed to turn out for Clinton, or it was down to Russian meddling. There was a global alignment of forces against liberalism. President Obama himself weighed in to declare that Trump, like Brexit, was an expression of protest against globalization. In fact, a deep dive into the poll data showed that Trump's voters were better off than the average American. The voters with the lowest incomes, overwhelmingly minorities, continued to vote Democratic. But a detailed accounting of the electoral statistics did show a significant shift to the Republicans among white male voters with less than a college education. It was less immediate misery than anxiety about the future that drove the Trump vote, fears that in the white population were associated with hostility to Latinos and black Americans, and among men, with hostility to upwardly mobile women. Trump improved on Romney's miserable tally in the Rust Belt states. Dog-whistle racism and nationalism solidified this constituency. Even an issue such as trade was saturated with racial markers. In one advertising spot after another, the face of the American worker displaced by foreign imports was that of a burly white man in a hard hat. And campaigning mattered. Concentrating their effort where it counted, the Republicans put in relentless legwork and media time in key Midwestern states that the Democrats considered theirs by right. The complacency, the refusal to countenance the reality of Trump's appeal, went deep. The Democrats offered nothing to counter Trump's manufacturing cargo cult. In answer to Trump's crude appeals to white male nationalism, Clinton offered anodyne conformity to the polite conventions of corporate globalism. That did not play with the 7 million Americans who had voted for Obama and now shifted to Trump. They were looking for a candidate who did not appear to represent the establishment. Though they constituted only 4% of the electorate, their votes were enough to hand Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin to the Republicans, rendering Clinton's huge tallies in New York and California irrelevant. What the Democratic operatives failed to understand was that the race was theirs to win, not to lose. Clinton was running to succeed a two-term Democratic presidency. A change was in order. The economy might not be the disaster that Trump suggested, but it was not booming. To overcome these handicaps, Clinton needed to energize the Democratic base. That she utterly failed to do. In the aftermath, the shock of Trump's election produced a state of confusion and stunned puzzlement reminiscent of Brexit. If Donald Trump had been elected president, who actually ruled America? Surely some branch of the establishment would intervene to constrain or redirect this aberrant popular choice. The idea of the deep state no longer belonged to the realms of marginalized conspiracy theory or radical critique. It was mainstream media discourse, and it influenced the Trump team themselves, who circulated memoranda on which bits of the deep state they would have to do battle with first. With the FBI and the CIA sifting through the evidence of Russian interference, and with Trump seemingly bent on picking a fight, it was from the security apparatus and law enforcement that the pushback was expected. But in truth, the entire establishment of the United States had lined up against the president-elect. In August 2016, The Wall Street Journal contacted every single surviving member of the President's Council of Economic Advisers back to the days of Richard Nixon, all 45 of them. Though 23 were Republican appointees, none would endorse Trump. Trump did not back down. If there was one thing he had been elected to do, it was to stir things up. This meant conflict. The more and the noisier, the better. He was set on his agenda of economic nationalism. It wasn't even a choice. He simply did not know any different. In December 2016, he intervened at Carrier, an Indianapolis manufacturer of furnaces and air conditioners, to persuade them to keep 1,000 jobs in the United States. The state of Indiana, where Trump's vice president Mike Pence was governor, stumped up millions in tax rebates. Company spokesmen helpfully announced that they had confidence in Trump's promise to reform the corporate tax code and to improve business conditions in the United States. Then the president-elect jetted in to Indianapolis to hail his first economic policy achievement and to reveal another reason why United Technologies' Carrier's parent might have wished to cooperate. "Companies are not going to leave the United States anymore without consequences," Trump declared menacingly. "Not going to happen. Leaving the country is going to be very, very difficult." Or as he tweeted later that weekend, "Any business that leaves our country for another country, fires its employees, builds a new factory or plant in the other country, and then thinks it will sell its product back into the U.S. without retribution or consequence, is wrong." For conventional commentators, it was jaw-dropping. Did the president-elect not understand that the success of American business depended precisely on their ability to deploy labor and capital globally? As several commentators remarked, his threatening tone was more like the populism of Hugo Chavez than even something Bernie Sanders would say. It's the kind of threat that will find its ultimate expression in currency controls, that favored instrument of economic dictators around the world. Had a left-winger engaged in such provocation, barring intervention by the Treasury and the Fed, the markets would surely have plummeted. But nothing of the sort happened in the wake of Trump's election. Trump was a challenger, but not all challengers are alike. Among Democratic voters, deep political grief went together with economic gloom. But what was no less remarkable was the reaction on the other side. Republican supporters of all kinds, from regular voters to small businesses and traders in the financial markets, exploded with new optimism. It was somewhat embarrassing to bigwigs on Wall Street who thought the new president was incompatible with their brand values, but bank shares were among those making the biggest gains. Trump liked to bang on about abolishing Dodd-Frank. If that happened, it would be good for the banks, at least in the short run. Healthcare stocks surged as markets anticipated a rollback of Obamacare and its cost-cutting. There was also a bump in infrastructure stocks. Meanwhile, bonds sold off as the prospect of Trumpflation made it all the more likely that the Fed would raise rates. And this Trump bump was only confirmed when the president set about recruiting a team. He kept loyalists and ideologues around him. He made no concessions on substance of policy, but he widened his coalition by stocking his cabinet with wealthy corporate managers and generals. The most astonishing thing, given the menacing rhetoric of his final attack ad, was the return of Wall Street. Trump supposedly canvassed Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan for Treasury Secretary, before plumping for the obvious alternative, Goldman Sachs. Both the number one and number two positions at the Treasury were to be filled by men, Steve Mnuchin and Jim Donovan, with Goldman Sachs pedigree. Dina Powell, who moved to the influential assistant position at the White House, had formerly headed the bank's philanthropic efforts. National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn was formerly Goldman's president. Meanwhile, to head the Securities and Exchange Commission, Trump's team proposed a partner from Goldman's main law firm, Sullivan & Cromwell. There was some anxiety from the White House chief of staff about the optics, but that was assuaged when Donovan withdrew. To a conventional programmatic political mind, this was a flagrant contradiction, and suggested that the establishment was reasserting control. But it was not clear whether Trump understood programmatic policy debate in the conventional sense. What Trump did understand or at least what he inhabited, was a raw world of power, a world dominated by a single logic: bully or be bullied. As one commentator put it, Trump viewed the world as a kind of Manhattan real estate market writ large, a vicious snake pit where the strong and hungry eat the weak and soft. From this point of view, the fact that Trump had criticized the leaders of Wall Street, then hired them as his subordinates, was not a sign of contradiction or self-subversion. It was a sign of his triumph. Trump's populism revolved not so much around policy as around the pure realization of power. He, Trump, was not only a successful businessman, he was also famous and had great TV ratings. He could challenge the establishment in his electoral campaign, pillory the chair of the Fed, and demonize the CEO of Goldman Sachs, and win. Having won, he could then audition Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan for Treasury Secretary, and reject him in favor of a minor Goldman Sachs alumnus who was more to his liking. If you could do all these things, you clearly were king of the hill, all the better for being king by popular acclamation. That is all Trump needed, and it was a story to which he returned obsessively. The revolving door that feeds government in America regularly rotates between public service and the corporate world. In firms like Goldman Sachs, the rotation is de rigueur for senior figures. It is not easy for a patriotic American to turn down an invitation from the White House to serve. But why, one has to ask, would a senior business figure be willing to be associated with such an administration? To which the simple answer is that Trump's victory changed everything. His objectionable personality and outlandish policy proposals now had to be weighed against the more basic political question of who would do what for whom. When it came to governing, it was not easy to fashion a coherent program out of such a mixed coalition. But there was one thing on which the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress could agree: overturning the Obama legacy. In this sense, after a campaign shaped by the aftereffects of 2008, the first phase of the Trump administration was also molded by the legacy of 2008, but in negative. The first 12 months of the Trump presidency offered an audit on the robustness of the state-building project pursued by the Democrats since the crisis. How much of it would stand up in the face of the onslaught of a Republican president and a Republican Congress? In 2008, pondering the fiscal track record of the George W. Bush administration, Brad DeLong had wondered what was the right strategic and tactical course for the Democrats, when there is no guarantee that any Republican successors will ever be normal again. 9 years on, the question was more pressing than ever. Since 2009, the congressional Republicans have been waging relentless political war, first against the stimulus, then the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Twice in 2011 and 2013, they had taken the debt ceiling hostage. Now, with control of both the presidency and Congress, what would they do? Obamacare was the scalp they wanted most, and it ought to have been easy. As it had emerged from its congressional ordeal in March 2010, the Affordable Care Act was mangled and flawed. But for all their grim determination, in the critical first 6 months of the Trump presidency, the Republicans could neither replace nor repeal it. What stood in their way was the inherent complexity of the subject matter and deep divisions within their party. But their failure also reflected the fact that the ACA, like any truly major piece of social or economic legislation, had created its own social constituency. Even an institution as deeply disappointing as the ACA was hard to budge once tens of millions of people came to depend on it and hundreds of billions of dollars began to flow through its channels. Indeed, among the states that benefited most from the extension of health coverage under Obamacare were Kentucky and West Virginia, diehard Trump country. As Trump took office, support for the ACA among the most important group of voters, independents, had risen from 36% in 2010 to 53%. By the summer, when the desperate Republican congressional leadership made a last bid simply to repeal Obamacare without replacement, they had the support of only 13% of Americans. Not surprisingly, sufficient Republican moderates refused to go along. If they couldn't repeal and replace Obamacare, what could they do? By the summer of 2017, it seemed that the incoherence of the Republicans, when faced with the complex reality of modern government, might prevent them from taking any effective action. The ACA fight had left little room on the legislative agenda. Trump's promised infrastructure program was a will-o'-the-wisp. Tax reform was much discussed with no apparent action. Meanwhile, basic financial questions could not be dodged. The debt ceiling remained in place, and when the Treasury hit its borrowing limit in the spring of 2017, it was forced to resort to the familiar makeshifts. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin vainly called on Congress to raise the ceiling. But in the summer, the House went into recess without a vote. In the meantime, the new director of the Office of Management and Budget was Mick Mulvaney, a founding member of the Freedom Caucus, which had diced with default in 2011 and 2013. He did not want to make concessions to the centrists or the Democrats. The extreme spending cuts demanded by his old friends in the Freedom Caucus had no majority. For Trump's budget director, a shutdown was not the worst option. If the United States was to crash into the debt ceiling and be forced to prioritize claims, a default in all but name, so be it. Astonishingly, the president seemed to agree. In May 2017, Trump tweeted blithely about a good shutdown. As the summer came to an end, despite their control of both the White House and Congress, it seemed as though the Republicans would fail to resolve the budget issue. The real question was whether the Democrats would allow them to drive the United States off the fiscal cliff. When Obama was in the White House, the Democrats had pilloried the Republicans for failing to carry their share of the burden of government. Could they refuse to back the president, even if the president was Trump? Before this dilemma could really bite, natural disaster intervened. With Hurricane Harvey having devastated a large part of Texas and another hurricane roaring into Florida, neither Trump nor the Democrats wanted to look inactive. At a meeting in the Oval Office on September 6th, the president did an about-face. He not only abandoned the Republican congressional leadership, but also cut off his own Treasury secretary in mid-sentence to strike a deal with the Democrats. It was a dizzying inversion that sent pundits scrambling for historical examples of independent presidents who had risen above the American party system. The realities were more hard-edged than that. With Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi having saved the administration from a shutdown, Trump was only too happy to cheer on the Republicans as they returned to the attack. Scrapping Obamacare might not sell as a political proposition, but cutting taxes surely would. The Republicans in the House and Senate began urgent work on tax reform. The resulting tax bill that passed both houses of Congress in December 2017 was hugely controversial. The sugarcoating, such as it was, consisted of across-the-board reductions in personal income taxation and cuts to exemptions that principally hit high-income local taxpayers in states that voted Democratic. But these were time-limited. Within a few years, many lower-income Americans would be paying higher taxes. Of more lasting benefit to the very wealthy was raising the estate tax threshold to $11 million. And what really mattered was a 40% cut in the rate of business taxation, which meant that profits could either be retained for growth or paid out to shareholders. Given the vast inequality in wealth holding, and particularly in the holding of equity, the top quintile of the American income distribution owns 90% of corporate equity, the benefits go to the better off. Then, for good measure, the Senate added the removal of the single-payer mandate that required all Americans to take out health insurance. Without this mandate, by most estimates, 13 million Americans would drop out of coverage. As many low-risk individuals left the insurance plans, the premiums for those who did remain would surge. DeLonge's fears were amply confirmed. In its redistributive impact and the scale of the giveaway, 2017 stood in comparison with a huge Reagan tax cut of 1981 and those of Bush in 2001 and 2003. To ease the passage of their tax measures through Congress, and to calm the nerves of fiscally conservative Republicans, the Treasury and fellow traveling Republican economists talked down the deficit implications. They resorted to the old Reagan-era arguments that lower tax rates would boost growth and thus raise government revenues. Even the notorious Laffer curve, purporting to show a positive relationship between lower tax rates and government revenue, made a comeback. But the vast majority of economists were scornful of these evasions. The tax cuts would clearly add to the deficit. Simpson and Bowles, who had headed Obama's National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, denounced the tax plan as a return to the era of deficit denial. In fact, it was not so much denial as hard-nosed political calculation. There was no way to cut the corporate tax rate to as little as 21% without incurring deficits. Nor did this scare the activist Republicans. As they saw it, the larger the deficits, the more urgent the need to move on to stage two of their program. With the tax cuts threatening to add $1.5 trillion to the national debt, spending cuts would be mandatory. Medicaid would be pared back as far as the law permitted, and the rest of the federal government would be cut to the bone. These were the Republican tactics not of the 1980s, but the 1990s. The congressional Republicans were starving the beast. Liberals were understandably indignant about the gross inequity of the tax proposal. The UN's special rapporteur on extreme poverty, who happened to be touring the United States visiting some of the 40 million Americans who lived in conditions of deep deprivation, denounced the tax plan as a bid to make the U.S. the world champion of extreme inequality. But even setting equity concerns aside, starving the beast was a failed fiscal strategy. Historically, the spending cuts that were supposed to follow on the tax cuts did not arrive. It was easier to rail against tax breaks than it was to get them repealed. Key areas of welfare spending had supporters even in the Republican ranks. At the same time, the Republican plans to expand the army by 10% and raise the navy to 355 fighting ships would increase military spending, the largest element of discretionary spending, by $683 billion, or 12%, over the decade to 2027. Rather than shrinking big government, the main effect of Republican fiscal tactics was likely to be a further reduction in America's already deeply inadequate tax base. Following the tax cuts, the federal government's take of GDP would fall to 17%, a figure befitting an emerging market state rather than the government of an advanced economy. In 2009, when a Democrat was in the White House appealing for Congress to provide a stimulus to the American economy as it plunged into the worst crisis since the 1930s, the Republicans had voted, to a man and a woman, against a stimulus. They denounced Obama's Recovery and Reinvestment Act as a ruinous demonstration of fiscal irresponsibility. Now, with unemployment at lows not seen since the boom time of 2007, but with Trump in the White House, they were working hard to deliver a 10-year, $1.4 trillion stimulus. In their defense, it might be said that given the sluggishness of the recovery and the large number of people who had retreated from the workforce during the crisis, there was a case to be made for running the economy hot. But even those who advocated such an adventurous policy found it hard to justify the Republican tax plan. America's wealthiest did not need further benefits. Investment was certainly depressed, but it was not for lack of funds. America's corporations had trillions of dollars in cash on hand. What was clearly long overdue was a public investment program to make good the embarrassing deficits in America's infrastructure. But there was little enthusiasm for that from Congress. The Republicans needed to end Trump's first year in office on a high. They needed to deliver for their donors. The 2017 tax reform did both. When budget hawks inside the Clinton and Obama administrations had worried about deficits, what was on their minds was market confidence. How would the markets react to the latest round of spendthrift Republican policy? Increasing the debt by perhaps as much as $1.5 trillion over 10 years ought surely to produce a reaction. Following the surprising election outcome, bond markets had been twitchy. Anticipating that the Trump administration would launch a major infrastructure drive and add further stimulus with tax reform, the markets expected the Fed to bring interest rate increases forward. Over the winter of 2016 to 2017, this prompted bonds to sell off and yields to rise. With the ECB and the Bank of Japan both engaged in QE, the dollar appreciated sharply, sending a ripple of uncertainty around the world of dollar borrowers. Their debt servicing costs were going up. But then, as the reality of the shambolic Trump administration and the continuing self-paralysis of the Republicans in Congress became clear, the fever broke. Driven by tech euphoria, the stock market continued to boom. The Fed insisted that it would continue its stepwise increase in interest rates, but there were few signs of panic in the bond market. The tax cuts with which the Republicans ended the year produced a shrug from the bond markets. As one analyst commented, "Whatever grade you assign to the end result, the bond market and economists are adding an extra minus to the grade. So if you think it's a B effort, the market's grade is a B minus." The markets weren't cheering, but neither did the Trump administration have vigilantes on its tail. The congressional infighting over Obamacare and the Republican tax cuts was bare-knuckle American politics. But a clue to the relative calm in the Treasury market could be found in the same set of influences that had also preserved calm in the face of the Bush-era deficits of the early 2000s, the global demand and supply of safe assets. In the fall of 2017, the IMF published a remarkable table that showed the issuance of debt since 2010. As this data revealed, austerity and QE had led to a major reshuffling of security portfolios. Given the budget control measures adopted in Europe, the active bond buying by the ECB, and the even greater activism of the Bank of Japan, they were, for the foreseeable future, not significant suppliers of safe assets to global investors. Not only was the ECB hoovering up Eurozone bonds, but Germany, the chief supplier of European safe assets, was running a budget surplus. On a global scale, over the next 5 years, the United States would be the only source of safe, treasury-grade assets for investors worldwide. Whatever you might think of the Trump administration, if you needed to park a large volume of funds in safe government debt, there was no alternative to U.S. treasuries. The Republican campaigns to roll back Obamacare and cut taxes were of long standing. Trump's targeting of Wall Street in his election campaign was more novel. But it made electoral sense. Almost a decade on from the financial crisis, the banks were still deeply unpopular. A poll in the summer of 2017 revealed that 60% of Americans still regarded Wall Street as a danger to our economy, and only 27% thought regulation had gone far enough or posed a threat to innovation or economic growth. Fully 47% of Trump's voters wanted to keep or expand Dodd-Frank, as opposed to only 27% favoring repeal or scaling back. When it came to financial products and services, 87% of Republicans and 90% of independents favored regulation. Wall Street lobbyists might wail against Dodd-Frank, but as the Obama administration insiders knew, it was they who had held back the popular tide running against the banks. And Trump, it turned out, was no different. His campaign attacks were politics pure and simple. The leaders of Wall Street had never liked Trump. They clearly preferred the Clinton brand. He had paid them back in kind, and he had won. The question of who was boss had been answered. Trump's about-face once in office was utterly unabashed. He would do as befitted a boss president. There would be a bonfire of regulations, and in particular, those of his predecessor. The thought of doing a big number on Dodd-Frank pleased POTUS, and it pleased him also to bestow favors on and receive applause from powerful interests, even those he had previously made a show of attacking. As he told a meeting of CEOs in April 2017, "For the bankers in the room, they'll be very happy." To have favors lavished on them by the man who had pilloried them on the stump might seem topsy-turvy, but the bankers were not complaining. As the Financial Times commented, "Imagine going to the races, betting 98% of your stake on the favorite, Clinton, which loses in the final stretch, and going home with huge winnings." As far as Wall Street was concerned, it turned out that the game of politics was heads I win, tails you lose. Neither the politicians nor Wall Street gave a second thought to the angry voters who had actually put Trump in the White House. To help with the gutting of Dodd-Frank, it was only too easy to find bank lobbyists and business-friendly economists. And enthusiasm also came from the Republicans in the House, led by Jeb Hensarling, who back in 2008 had spearheaded opposition to the bailouts and was now chairman of the Financial Services Committee. The House rapidly passed the so-called Financial Choice Act, where CHOICE stands for Creating Hope and Opportunity for Investors, Consumers, and Entrepreneurs. It not only defanged Dodd-Frank, it was libertarian purism. It would scrap the Volcker Rule and make stress tests a biannual rather than an annual affair. It eliminated the orderly liquidation authority, insisting that failing banks should simply be referred to the bankruptcy courts. Astonishingly, in the name of the freedom to choose, the CHOICE Act even promised to gut Elizabeth Warren's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. For an administration habitually decried as populist, the remarkable thing was how spectacularly unpopular such legislation would have been. Like ACA repeal, the CHOICE Act had little or no chance of passing the blocking position the Democrats held in the Senate. As in the battle against Obamacare, the struggle was best waged outside the spotlight. Even if Dodd-Frank remained in place, the regulatory regime was fair game. This was a legacy of the discretionary conception of financial governance that framed Dodd-Frank. Pursuing maximum freedom from congressional interference, Geithner's Treasury had pushed for the agencies to have the widest possible latitude in their regulatory efforts. Now that discretion could be used to fundamentally change the regime of bank supervision without the need for legislation. Mnuchin's Treasury began preparing a series of reports on its approach to financial regulation, opening the door to the bank lobby. By one count, fully 75% of the bankers' recommendations were incorporated into the Treasury's new regulatory blueprint. Unpicking the Volcker Rule, which had taken almost 4 years to assemble, began by asking the banks how they would like it changed. In November 2017, rather than scrapping the orderly liquidation authority and restoring the role of the bankruptcy courts as the CHOICE Act had proposed, the Treasury decided that it preferred to retain control over the liquidation of a megabank in crisis. Even if there were to be no more bailouts, the prospect of another Lehman was not attractive. The Trump administration exposed the basic weakness of Geithner's regulatory design. It depended on those operating the law to have a programmatic commitment to systemic stability. Without that, the legislation per se was largely empty. Arguably, the most radical section of the CHOICE Act was the provisions pertaining to the Fed. They constituted an all-out assault on central bank activism as practiced by Ben Bernanke. In the future, the CHOICE Act demanded near total transparency of all Fed meetings. The Act called for the FOMC to declare a mathematical policy rule to justify its interest rate choices. As its default, the Act specified the so-called Taylor Rule, named after John B. Taylor of Stanford University, a favorite of the right and a longtime academic rival of Ben Bernanke. His rule called for interest rates to be set as the sum of the rate of inflation over the previous 4 quarters, one half of the difference between the real GDP and an estimate of potential GDP, one half of the difference between the rate of inflation over the previous 4 quarters and 2%, and an assumed real interest rate of 2%. It was a mechanical formula that required interest rates to be adjusted upward if inflation was high and unemployment low, or downward if the reverse was the case. If the Fed preferred a different rule, the CHOICE Act stipulated that it must spell out its own formula in similarly mechanical terms and demonstrate econometrically that its rule was preferable to the Taylor model. As the authors of the bill were well aware, enshrining this formula in law implied an entire alternate history of American monetary policy back to the crisis and before. Taylor and his disciples blamed the crash on the fact that in the early 2000s, under Greenspan, rates had been too low. During the crisis, on the other hand, if one applied the Taylor formula, interest rates should have been pushed into negative territory. A strict application of the Taylor rule in the autumn of 2008 would have called for rates of below zero, effectively a tax on savings deposits. It was because he judged that impracticable that Bernanke had adopted quantitative easing. The Choice Act would ban any such improvisation. Once the acute crisis had passed, instead of QE2 and QE3, Taylor's formula would have called for rate increases. There would have been no worrying about taper tantrums, whether at home or abroad. Indeed, no regard would be paid to conditions anywhere in the world other than the United States, unless, of course, the Fed dared to include its wider global concerns as a variable in its own interest rate equation. The Choice Act was first and foremost a political gesture. Promising to curb the discretion of the Fed played well on the Republican side. But on the substance of policy, there was in fact no disagreement. Taylor rule or not, 2017 was clearly a time to tighten, to raise rates, and to start, tentatively, unwinding the gigantic balance sheet built up during the era of QE. After ending security purchases under QE3 in October 2014, the Fed had made the first move to raise rates in December 2015. It had then paused, before inching them up again in December 2016, March 2017, and June 2017. The FOMC ended 2017 by laying a path of at least three further increases in 2018. As always, a subtle game was played out between the FOMC and the markets. Janet Yellen proved herself a master of this game, managing to socialize the idea of rate increase without triggering panic. But there was never much chance of her tenure being extended into the Trump presidency. There was talk that John B. Taylor himself might be in line to take Yellen's place. Trump liked the look of Kevin Warsh, an underqualified New York princeling who had been parachuted onto the Fed board by the Bush White House in 2006. But in the end, he settled on Jerome Powell. It was a strikingly conventional choice. Powell was a Republican investment banker in the Mitt Romney-Hank Paulson vein. He had earned the trust of the Obama administration by campaigning within the Republican Party against the shutdown of 2011. That had led to his nomination to the Fed board in December 2011, where he had distinguished himself by his loyalty to both Bernanke and Yellen. He was also thought to be supportive of the Dodd-Frank framework. But what recommended Powell to Trump were most likely his personal attributes. He was not an academic economist. He was a rich businessman. With a personal net worth estimated in excess of $100 million, Powell was by far the wealthiest person to take the position of Fed chair since the 1930s. Unlike Professor Taylor, Powell was non-doctrinaire when it came to policy. Under his stewardship, the White House would not have to fear unduly painful increases in interest rates. Building a new administration and setting a domestic policy agenda was a protracted and complex business, for which Trump and his coterie were ill-prepared. All the more forceful was their approach to foreign relations, where the White House and the executive branch had far more leeway. Within 48 hours of his inauguration on Friday, January 20, 2017, Trump announced his intention to renegotiate NAFTA. The next day, Monday, January 23rd, he withdrew the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. TTIP, the object of years of laborious negotiation with the EU, was also left for dead. It was a spectacular overturning of a centerpiece of Obama-era foreign economic policy. TPP was a showpiece of American grand strategy in the multipolar age. It was a shock to America's allies. Committing to TPP had cost many Asian countries, most notably